Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, it's that time again. I am A.B. Dauji and this is The Big Picture, the program in which we look at what's happening on the world stage. We shine the spotlight on the various categories of big shot politicians, ranging from lying laddus to absolute alus, but focusing mainly on miscellaneous mamparas. No one is spared. No one is spared a lacquer tight clap or a swift kick in the pants. Now, I was going to go straight into some very serious stuff. Serious stuff. But you know what? I came across a story this morning. It's quite a strange one and maybe a little bit funny too. And the reason why I am telling you about it is because it is in a way, well, sort of related to me. Now hear this. Mr. Stephen Bennett from Burnaby, which is in British Columbia in Canada, and his wife and son were on their way to Cuba and had a stopover in Toronto. This was on the 13th of October. He says he did not sleep on the overnight flight from the westernmost province of British Columbia and so took a sleeping pill prescribed by his doctor before the connecting flight. Mr. Bennett, who is recovering from a stroke, boarded early and fell asleep immediately. He says he next remembers waking up when his wife nudged him and the flight attendant told him he had to go because he was a medical emergency. That's what the flight attendant told him. He says there may have been some initial confusion because his wife's first language is not English and she wanted him to rest. But once he was awake, he was able to explain he had taken medication. Paramedics were called and removed him from the plane in a wheelchair. He says they checked him once he was off the plane and told WestJet airline crew that his vitals were fine and he was able to fly. But to no avail. He was not allowed back onto the plane. He says also he was able to get his doctor to email a note saying he was healthy enough for the flight. And he said, it was so humiliating. Basically, the stewardess became judge, jury, and executioner. The airline said that in any instance where its crew believes a passenger is showing signs of not being fit to fly, that passenger will be removed out of an abundance of caution. It noted that those instances include significant impairment arising from the consumption or use of alcohol or drugs prior to boarding. WestJet Airlines says that their action is in line with federal transport regulations. So, there you are. He took a sleeping... So how is it all of this related to me? Well, dear listeners, as you know, I fly quite a lot. Now, I was at home chatting to my brother and his friend a few days before my next trip. This is some time ago. I said that I have very great difficulty sleeping on these long flights, about 8 or 9 hours, sometime even longer. And when I arrived in whatever destination, Egypt or Casablanca or Bosnia or Russia, I'm usually quite bubble-assed. No sleep. Well, my brother took out a tiny tablet and said, take this. It works very well. You will feel fresh. So a few days later, I took off on an Emirates flight and they upgraded me to business class. That was, of course, wonderful. And we stopped on the way. We had to stop in Dubai for 3 or 4 hours. Before we take the next connecting flight of maybe another 6 or 7 hours to go to our destination. And of course, I went to business class lounge and I took out my laptop and started working on it. And then after a while, there was an announcement that my flight was about to leave. Well, I quickly finished what I was doing on my laptop, closed the laptop, And just as I was leaving the lounge, then I remembered, hey, I got this tablet in my pocket. So I then quickly grabbed the water, some water, and swallowed the tablet. And then I dashed off to my departure gate. Time was short, so I ran fast. Now, you know, as most of you know, Dubai airport is huge, very long. And I ran and ran, and when I got to the end, I realized that I was at the wrong end. And the other end was very far away. So I got panic-stricken. I started running faster and faster and breathing heavily and so on. I just managed to reach my boarding. Heart was beating like crazy. And there were just the last few, about half a dozen passengers ready to board the plane. And two young girls from my group were at the last people in the line. And when I came there huffing and puffing, they said, "Hey, Uncle Abe, you made it, eh? We thought you were going to get left behind." And I just laughed. And as we were walking along to get onto the plane, on that long chute, as we were about to get on, I said, "Hey, why is the chute swing like that? It must be very windy outside." And they just laughed. And as I was boarding the plane, I sort of, you know, there's like a ledge before you get on. I tripped and almost stumbled. And then these girls laughed again. And as we were walking along, I said, "Look, I am going to the left. You people are going to the right. I'm going to be in business class." I said, laughing. I said, "Okay, ciao, see you later." And, well, that's all. I said, "I'm going to have majade. I'm going to business class." And that's all I remember. Now, next thing, when I opened my eyes, I felt wonderful, very, very relaxed. I had a smile on my face. I had a fantastic sleep. I felt fresh. And I was flat out. You know, business class, your seat goes flat like a bed. And I was lying there thinking, wow, this is fantastic. Then I'm thinking now, why have I was still strapped in with the seat belts. And I wondered, why have I still got my jacket on? Because normally I take my jacket and put it on the overhead compartment there. Why had I then? Well, that thought didn't really, I didn't think about it too much. And then I took off the seat belts, got up, and I said, "Let me go and tease the people in my group at the back. Let me tease them that I was in business class, I had a lekker dos and all." So as I walked, I greeted some terrible-looking people. They all faces puffed up. They didn't have sleep, and I was making fun of them. And I came to the end. I came to the two young girls, and they said, "Uncle Abe, how are you?" I said, "Hey, I feel lovely. A business class. I am always going to sit in business class. I feel very nice." They said, "No, but how are you feeling?" I said, "I just told you I'm feeling nice. I feel lovely." They said, "You don't know what happened to you." I said, What you mean, what happened to me?" They said, "You know what? When you took that turn to go to business class, and we were walking along to our economy seats, one of the girls said, "I just turned around to have a look and saw you wobbling very badly." I said, "What?" They said, "Yes, you were wobbling, and the air hostesses came and held you, and I came running back, and they were very alarmed. They said, 'This man is drunk.'" I said, "What? What are you talking about?" They said, "No, we came and we explained to them, and they were ready to take you off the plane. But we explained to them that you had taken a tablet, which you told us about before that. And so they took you and they put you in your seat and they strapped you up. And while they were doing all this trying to get you in your seat, you started making some hell of a funny faces at them." "Hell of a funny faces. And then you started singing loudly." I said, "No, don't tell me that." They said, "Yes, you started singing very loudly. And finally they managed to strap you and you started snoring loudly." So, dear listeners, that was an embarrassing episode in my life. Eh? Imagine they could have put me in a wheelchair and taken me right off. And I would have been parking in a throng somewhere in Dubai. Anyway, let's get to some serious stuff now, okay? Let's see, what have we got for you? Well, as you all know, just over a week ago, 46-year-old Robert Bowers walked into the Pittsburgh synagogue and opened fire with a machine gun. 11 Jews were killed. That was a horrible act of murder, and it was rightfully condemned by people all around the world. It's horrible, horrible that innocent people, well, in this case, ranging in age from 54 to 97 years old, are mowed down in cold blood. And worse, that it happened in a place of worship. In the United States, everyone condemned the killings, and that's right, and politicians on every level said that it was a dastardly act. The media gave it full, in-depth coverage. Everyone agreed that it was an evil act. But there was also an underlying message. This was carried out by a right-wing loony, a racist, a white ultra-extremist. But here's the thing. Many agreed that these right-wing extremists were inspired or are inspired by the sentiments, the words, the statements of Donald Trump. Last week I told you about the dog whistle. Donald J. Trump, J of course as you know means jungly, in his speeches gives a coded message of white supremacy, white nationalism and superiority, of white Christians being targeted by other groups, and so we have to circle the lager, we have to look after ourselves. Other groups, of course, he's pointing to Jews and Muslims and Mexicans and refugees and all sorts of other, and of course blacks also. So white nationalists listening to him say, hey, let's do something about it. They are reacting to Trump's dog whistle. And so this nut job, Robert Bowers, decided to do something about it. Let me go and kill some Jews. And so it happened. And so people say that Trump's words inspired this this character. And when he said he was going to the synagogue in Pittsburgh, that is, Donald Trump said he's going to go, after the shooting, he was going to go to the synagogue in Pittsburgh to pay his respects. Many Jewish people said, do not come. Do not come. The message was clear. You are responsible for promoting hate against the Jews and thereby inspiring these white, right, nutcases, these racists, this right-wing racist to do what they do. Well, why am I emphasizing this? Because Israel has taken a completely different position on this. Israel cannot say that Trump was responsible for the murder of the Jews in the synagogue by his embracing of the white right-wing racists. They cannot. Why? Because Trump is a great friend and ally of Israel. He, as you all know, moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. He is a great friend of Israel. So even if he is guilty of hate speech against Jews in a coded manner, in a very subtle manner, the dog whistle, it would be completely foolish for Israel to criticize him. And so it's better to say that Bowers was inspired by something else. And guess what? The blame is put on the left wing, can you believe it? The left wing, liberals, that they always criticize Israel, and also Muslims condemn Israel, so that's why people attack Jews. Can you believe it? It's not the right wing, it's the left wing. You think I'm making all this up? Pulling out theories from fresh air? No, dear listeners, this is not just my views. It was stated right there in Israel in an editorial
in the leading Israeli newspaper, Haaretz.
Here's what it says. It says here, as if the political affiliation of the murderer from Pittsburgh were not known to everyone, it was very important to Israel's ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, to cover up the killer's connection to his ideological home. That means the right-wingers. He said in an interview with MSNBC, one of the big forces in college campuses today is anti-Semitism, and those anti-Semites are usually not neo-Nazis on college campuses. They're coming from the radical left. The article says the fact that the man who entered the Tree of Life synagogue Saturday morning and ended the lives of 11 people is a declared member of the far right, a xenophobic white racist ultra-nationalist, doesn't make any special impression on Dermer. He insists on pointing a finger at anti-Semites from, in his words, the radical left. Instead of talking about the negative influence of the discourse of hatred and the far-right spirit in President Donald Trump's America, Dermer turns the spotlight across the sea to the leader of the British Labour Party, whom he calls the anti-Semitic Jeremy Corbyn, and to anti-Semitism in Europe. Nor did Dermer miss an opportunity to blame the Muslims. He insisted on mentioning that Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan called the Jews termites the previous week. He was also asked about some statement last year describing neo-Nazi demonstrators in Charlottesville who shouted, "Jews will not replace us as good people." And Dermer said he was not aware of a single non-Israeli leader that has made such a strong statement in condemning anti-Semites, which, of course, he was referring to Donald Trump's condemnation of the murders in Pittsburgh. Dermer's words reflect the abyss between American Jews and the Israeli government. Many American Jews believe that the massacre in Pittsburgh reflects the rise of the far right in the United States under the sponsorship of Trump, whom they say encourages racists and anti-Semites and defends their right to bear arms. But while they criticized Trump's violent messages and his use of the term globalist, for example, which has clear anti-Semitic connotations, Israeli officials prefer to handle the far right and Trump with kid gloves. It's hard not to conclude that the government considers the far right in the United States and elsewhere a partner in the battle against extremist Islam and infiltrators, and sees its strengthening as a stamp of approval for continuing the occupation and deporting asylum seekers. Well, there you are, from the Haaretz newspaper. Isn't that amazing, dear listeners? Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, doesn't want to point to the elephant in the room, the ultra-racist white right wing, and also to Donald Trump as being responsible for the Pittsburgh murders. No, 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 no. It's the left wing. The left wing critics of Israel. It's Jeremy Corbyn of the British Labour Party, a strong critic of Israel. And of course, it's Farrakhan to add to the masala mix. It's Muslims also. Well, he's talking a whole lot of sheer nonsense. Sheer nonsense. John Dermer. John Dermer. I think we'll go for a quick break and come back, and there's much more on the same subjects. As I was saying, if Israel criticizes the right-wing racist, then it means criticizing their mentor, which is Donald Trump. It's not the time to shame the devil by speaking the truth. So, let me underline this. Politicians and the media have been giving, and rightfully so, huge coverage to this killing in the synagogue but have been speaking about the wider issue of how Jews in America are targeted, anti-Jewish attitudes known as anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is, of course, wrong and must be condemned, as it has been very strongly over the past week. But hang on, isn't there a great deal of hypocrisy in all of this? There is a huge focus on and strong words about how wrong it is to target a religious minority in America. But then what about the other religious minority, the Muslims in America? The attack on Jews is wrong, but it is done by a small fringe group known as the white right-wing racists, a relatively small group that is strongly condemned. Did you get that? A relatively small group regarded as loonies. And whenever they raise their heads, they get slammed very heavily. But when it comes to Muslims in America, they are attacked by a very large group of Americans, politicians right across the board, and they are hardly ever condemned for doing so. Do you get my point? It's almost normal in America to say the worst things about Muslims and Islam, and it's regarded as acceptable. It's fine. It's okay. Par for the course. No problem. Again, I'm not just plucking this out of the air. There's a huge amount of evidence to back this up. Anti-Muslim bigotry in the United States has been there for a very long time, and after 9/11, it went into overdrive. And when Donald Jungly began campaigning for president, he went all out to pour petrol on the existing fire of anti-Muslim bigotry. So let me back up what I'm saying with some fresh research from 2nd November 2018. The headline in the Al Jazeera website is, 2 in 5 Americans say Islam is incompatible with U.S. values. The article says a large proportion of non-Muslim Americans think Islam is incompatible with American values. Research by the New America Foundation and the American Muslim Institution found, according to the findings announced on Thursday, 56% of Americans believe Islam was not compatible with American values. Researchers found that Republicans were more likely to hold, that's Donald Trump's party, were more likely to hold negative perceptions of Muslims than Islam, with 71% saying Islam was incompatible with American values. About 56% of Republicans also admitted they would be concerned if a mosque was built in their neighborhood. Rabia Ahmed, an American Muslim media relations specialist, told Al Jazeera that politicians, segments of the media, and religious leaders from other communities had played a role in stoking anti-Muslim bigotry. She says, fears of Muslims comes from the acts of extremists. It comes from the Islamophobia industry, a very well-connected, very well-funded industry, which makes it their mission to try to marginalize and disenfranchise American Muslims. Last month, a report by Muslim advocates found 80 instances of clear anti-Muslim rhetoric by candidates, that's politicians running for political office. That included unfounded claims that Muslims were plotting to establish Islamic law in the United States. U.S. President Donald Trump also used anti-Islam rhetoric in his election campaign and has introduced executive orders targeting Muslims, such as his infamous ban on Muslims from several predominantly Muslim countries entering the United States. Zainab Aryan from the Council of American Islamic Relations, that is CARE, said people with anti-Muslim views were found at the very highest level of government. She says these are people who were formerly part of the Trump administration who are well-known anti-Muslim bigots. You have people who are currently in the administration who are closely connected to the established anti-Muslim hate groups. I got a lot of material about that. Maybe I'll come back to it. 2 in 5 Americans say Islam is incompatible with U.S. values. Well, there you are, folks. The media and top politicians have been attacking Muslims for a very long time, and it's regarded as acceptable. So isn't that a perfect example of stinking hypocrisy? Strongly condemning the attacks by a small fringe group on Jews, but at the same time, find it acceptable that a large sector of U.S. society, politicians and the media, condemn Islam and Muslims. And here's something that I've said before, which is both ironical and shocking. Many Jews who support Israel, and they are called Zionists in the United States, are leading these hate groups, anti-Muslim groups, and organizations that declare Islam and Muslims as evil. The game is very simple, you see, very simple. Follow this. You make Islam look bad and evil, and therefore Muslims are bad, and so these mad Muslims are against Israel. You see? Muslims are against Israel. It's not about human rights. People are not fighting, Palestinians are not fighting for human rights, or the Arab world, or any other Muslims who are standing up for the Palestinians. They're not fighting for human rights that Israel is committing against the Palestinians. It's not the occupation of Palestine, Palestinian lands, or the systematic oppression of Palestinians. That's the problem. It's the fact that the evil teachings of Islam make Muslims do bad things. They go crazy. The deeper they go into the scriptures, the more crazy they get, and therefore they do bad things like jihad and so on. It's got nothing to do with human rights, you see. Israel is doing nothing to the Palestinians. So that's why you have to, in America, make Islam and Muslims seem evil, very bad, and then in the minds of people, the Israelis would look good. The Islamophobic industry has been going full steam, as I said, making Muslims look bad. Right? Let me repeat that. The Islamophobia industry has been going full steam, both in America and in Europe. Their organization, one is called, just one, there are many, many organizations. One is called Stop the Islamization of America. And the one in Europe is also called something similar, Stop the Islamization of Europe. And they are going full steam and making Muslims look bad. But now I want to ask a very big question. Okay, take a deep breath, sit back, and here's the question. Are the actions and the behavior of Muslims making Muslims look bad? Did you get that? Are the actions and the behavior of Muslims making Muslims look bad? Yes, of course we have enemies. But are we ourselves our worst enemies? Let me put it this way. If you were not a Muslim, how would you view Muslims? There you are. The objective now, right? Okay. Unbiased. If you were not a Muslim, how would you view Muslims? Let us be brutally honest. There are some Muslims who give Muslims a bad name. Let me give you a fresh example. The goings on in Pakistan this week. Sure, Imran Bhai is really riding a tiger. I wonder if Imran Khan knew exactly what he was getting into when he decided to become Prime Minister. People are ready to bowl him out. So if you were not a Muslim, how would you view what happened in Pakistan, continuing to happen, in fact, this week? Asia Bibi, a Christian, was acquitted of the charge of blasphemy. And then all hell broke loose. Here's an extract from an article setting the background. What was Asia Bibi accused of? The trial stems from an argument Asia Bibi, whose full name is Asia Noreen, had with a group of women in June 2009. They were harvesting fruit when a row broke out about a bucket of water, the women said that because she had used a cup, they could no longer touch it, as her faith had made it unclean. Prosecutors allege that in the row which followed, the women said Asia Bibi should convert to Islam and that she made offensive comments about the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in response. She was later beaten up at her home, during which her accusers say she confessed to blasphemy. She was arrested after a police investigation. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court of Pakistan acquitted her, saying that the case was based on flimsy evidence and her confession was delivered in front of a crowd which was threatening to kill her. Did you absorb all of that? And what do you make of that? Asia Bibi, according to Pakistan's Supreme Court, was wrongly accused of blasphemy. She was sentenced to death in 2010, wrongly. She was jailed and was put into solitary confinement for 8 years. Solitary confinement for 8 years. Did you get that? She has 5 kids. That is so wrong. The Supreme Court said it was wrong, and on Wednesday, it freed her. And as I said, all hell broke loose. Thousands marched all over Pakistan. The Tariq-e-Labbaik party, led by a Maulana, organized this whole tamasha. No, they said, the Supreme Court is wrong. The 3 judges who delivered the verdict must be killed. Prime Minister Imran Khan, who supports the Supreme Court judgment, must also be killed. Many of those demonstrators chanted. And of course, Asia Bibi must be killed. Kill, kill, kill. How did it all start? Because a Christian lady drank from a bucket, took a cup of water from a bucket. Can you believe it? If you were not a Muslim, how would you view all of this? Thousands marching, kurtas and beards and everything, marching and screaming, kill, 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 kill. You would conclude that this is the face of Islam. These are the dangerous loony Muslims. They don't respect their own Supreme Court, their own Prime Minister, pleading for sanity to prevail. They want to kill a woman for drinking water. And if you were not a Muslim, how would you view the attack yesterday in Egypt? Listen to this. Islamic militants have ambushed 3 buses carrying Christian pilgrims on the way to a remote desert monastery south of the Egyptian capital of Cairo, killing 7 people and wounding 19. All but one of those killed were members of the same family, according to a list of the victims' names released by the Coptic Orthodox Church, which said among the dead were a boy and a girl aged 15 and 12, respectively. Some may say, of course, no, it was not Islamic militants, as the article claims. It was possibly carried out by people, third force, who wanted to make Muslims look bad. You know what? We are ready to make excuses. Ready to make excuses. Let me tell you this. I knew someone very well some time ago, a highly intelligent man, Muslim, a knowledgeable person, well-educated, well-traveled. He said to me when such an attack, this kind of attack took place on Christians, yes, they deserve to die. You know, I was shocked. I asked him why. And he answered, because they made Jesus the God. He actually hated Christians. And the whole region, in the Arab world, there are many like him. And beyond also, Afghanistan and Pakistan, all over. Here in South Africa, we really don't know how Muslims think in other places. Here, we are shocked at what happened in Verulam, for example. We distance ourselves from such acts. But in other places, many people celebrate such lunacy. A bomber explodes himself in a mosque in Pakistan, killing women and children, old people, and there are many who support such actions. loony stuff. And how will a non-Muslim view such actions? Will he believe you when you say that Islam is a religion of peace? It's an uphill battle. On the one hand, we want to promote Islam as a religion of peace and harmony and justice and sensibility. And then a loony comes along and blows it all up. So the question, are Muslims responsible for giving Islam and Muslims a bad name? And I'm speaking about some Muslims. Well, I suppose you know the answer to that one. And the second question, if you were not a Muslim, how would you view Islam and Muslims? The answer is, of course, not very well. So maybe we should get our own house in order first before we tackle the Islamophobes. That's, of course, a very easy job, isn't it? Getting our house in order. And the answer to that is, in the words of our beloved former president, Yaqub Bey, the Ummah is so divided, so many different groups, each one claiming to be the guardians, the custodians of the real Islam, the true Islam. That's what each one claims, that they are the custodians, the guardians of the true Islam. Let me say something here, without meaning to come across, without meaning to be offensive, let me put it that way. So listen carefully, right? I don't know. Listen carefully. Right. I don't mean to be offensive when I say this, so please don't get your bone saws out, okay? You know, I never expected there to be such a big split in the Tabligh Jamaat. These brothers and sisters appear so calm and relaxed, always, and peaceful, and always emphasize that we should improve ourselves inwardly. Be better Muslims ourselves before we want to change the world. And suddenly, shockingly, there is this huge jagra, the big split, lots of anger and very harsh words from both sides. I've heard some of them. It shocked me, really. So, how are we all, that so many groups, all of these groups, going to commit ourselves to Allah's command that we should hold fast all together. We should hold fast all together to the rope and not be divided. How are we going to do that? How are we, so many disparate groups, or different groups, how many are there? Pakistan alone probably got a couple of dozen. How are we going to commit ourselves to Allah's command that we should hold fast all together to the rope and not be divided? I have no answer to that. I have no answer to that. Right, let me skim very quickly to something else. We've got a few minutes left. So what happened yesterday? Why was yesterday historic in what's been happening in the Muslim world yesterday? Hands up, anyone? Oh, I see a whole sea of hands there. Yeah. Listeners of The Big Picture are so smart, eh? Well, I'll tell those who don't know, yesterday, November 2nd, 1917, 101 years ago, Arthur Balfour, Britain's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, addressed a letter to Lord Rothschild, one of the leaders of the British Jews, and it was known as the Balfour Declaration. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine all the right and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Well, that statement was exceedingly brief, consisting of mere 67 words, but its consequences were both profound and pervasive, and its impact on the subsequent history of the Middle East was nothing less than revolutionary. These are the words of Avi Shlaim, a Jewish historian. It completely transformed the position of the fledgling Zionist movement vis-à-vis the Arabs of Palestine, and it provided a protective umbrella that enabled the Zionists of Europe to proceed steadily towards the ultimate goal of establishing an independent Jewish state in Palestine. Rarely in the annals of the British Empire has such a short document produced such far-reaching consequences. And of course, you know the consequences for Palestine when Britain made this. And in fact, the effect of this declaration was summed up by the late British author and journalist Arthur Koestler. He said, "One nation solemnly promised to a second nation the country of a third. It had no moral or legal right to do so." Balfour started it all way back. Gave them the visa, the Zionists of Europe. And you know the consequences of that. Light at the end of the tunnel. Right, quickly. Van der Merwe was the new South African ambassador to Britain. As was the tradition, he and his wife were invited to Buckingham Palace. At the dinner table, he was seated next to Prince Charles. So he decided to chat with Prince Charles.
"Here, Prince, you got a hell of a nice house, eh?"
And Prince Charles replied, "Eh, jolly good of you to say so, old boy." And Van says,
"Yeah, and Prince, the food is lekker too, eh?"
And Van's wife leans over and whispered in his ear, "Don't call him Prince, call him Your Highness." And so Van turned to the Prince and said,
"Yes, sir, Prince, my cousin's name is also Your Highness, eh?"
Bidding you all, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.